Hello again, this is Dan Rodericks of the Baltimore Sun, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 215 for February 17th, 2017. Special music to open the show today because of our featured guest, Nico Sarbanes, a 23-year-old jazz musician who's just releasing his first recordings. Nico Sarbanes is the son of a Maryland congressman, the grandson of a former U.S. senator, and the great-grandson of a klezmer violinist. A trumpet player and singer, and student of jazz, Nico Sarbanes joins us today to talk about his ambition to capture the Baltimore sound.
When I first started listening to small group jazz in the middle of high school, I wanted to find as many Baltimore artists as I could to understand not just the history, but also an idea of what the Baltimore sound is like. Because I do think there is a distinct Baltimore sound to the scene here that is just infused with blues, gritty, bluesy, tinges of gospel.
Nico Sarbanes joins us in a few minutes. First, a couple of messages, and then Paula Gallagher's weekly book recommendation.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. McKay Jenkins presents Food Fight, which explores the history and science of our industrial food system. Wednesday, February 22nd at 7 p.m. at the Ivy. More at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.
Hi, I'm Quinn Kelly, and I host a weekly podcast for the Baltimore Sun called Female Trouble. Each Tuesday, we feature a new long-form conversation with one of the area's most interesting and accomplished women, from public officials and congresswomen to rappers and restaurant owners. You can find Female Trouble on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Find more info at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble.
And the latest episode of Female Trouble features Diane Bell McCoy, the president and CEO of Associated Black Charities, a foundation that addresses racial disparities in Baltimore and across Maryland. Time again for our weekly book recommendation from Paula Gallagher. Okay, Paula, what do you have for us this week?
This week I have a science fiction title, and it's a mass market book with appeal really for any reader. It's All Our Wrong Todays by Elan Mastai. And he's a Canadian screenwriter. This is his first outing as a novelist. And again, I like high concept books, and this one really did it for me. It takes place in 2016, but as the narrator describes, a man named Tom Barron, it's the 2016 that people in the 1950s thought we would have. So there are hover cars and moving sidewalks and jetpacks and and these machines that are able to make you custom clothing every morning based on your needs and produce your food in much the same way. It's a techno-utopia. So our main character, Tom Barron, is the son of a very famous scientist who's working on time travel. But Tom Barron, the son, is kind of a slacker. He's 32. He's not really very successful in anything. He's in the shadow of his famous father. Things aren't going well for him, but he gets involved in his father's work, and he's going to be a chrononaut. In other words, travel in time. He ends up in the time machine, goes back, and where's he going? Well, what made the future what it is in 2016 in this book is that there was a perpetual energy generator that was invented in 1965, produced clean energy in massive amounts to power anything. So if you can imagine a future where you didn't worry about energy, you didn't worry about the environment, where it was coming from, price, all of that, it's taken care of. Really great conceit here.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes back in time to the time of this generator engine being turned on. And because he travels, of course, he changes the course of time and history. And so now he wakes up and he's in an alternate timeline. He's not in the future. He's still in 2016, but it's more of our 2016. Still technological advances, but not like where he came from. So what did I like about this book? It really kept me on the edge of my seat. It's well written, it's literary, and in fact, it's not being marketed just to the typical science fiction audience. It's smart, it's funny, it's surprising. There are lots of plot twists. It's very thought-provoking when we think about how would things alter, how would things be different. It's got a love story at its core. And it's one I would recommend, and here's my mashup here. Fans of The Martian, now if you liked it because the science was so good, okay, don't get caught up in the science here because, of course, this author is making stuff up, mm-hmm. but you'll still go along with it and enjoy it. Fans of Star Trek, Futurama, and The Time Traveler's Wife.
All our wrong todays. The author is Ilan Mastai,
Mastai, yes.
Mastai. Thank you, Paula.
Thanks, Dan.
Paula Gallagher is a librarian with the Baltimore County Public Library. She recommends a book a week here on the Roughly Speaking podcast. That trumpet you hear is that of Nico Sarbanes, the 23-year-old son of Maryland Congressman John Sarbanes, the grandson of former U.S. Senator Paul Sarbanes. Nico Sarbanes has been working for several years to develop his talents as a trumpeter and vocalist, and his ensemble performances with four accomplished Baltimore artists, recorded live in 2015 at Andy Musique in Baltimore, are now being released on CD. So where'd you learn to do that? How long have you been playing a trumpet?
I've been playing trumpet since, well, probably around when I was 10 years old.
What happened when you were 10 years old? Did a trumpet salesman come to the house? How did you get to be a trumpet student at 10? What happened?
At the school I went to in Baltimore County, they had what is called an exploratory music unit where fourth graders get to try out violin, trumpet, and clarinet each for an extended period of time. And so that's supposed to set you up for either being in the string family, woodwind family, or brass family. And I guess I took to the trumpet well enough that I that one, I guess, stood out to me.
So did you try all three?
Yeah. And violin, I sort of regret not taking more to violin because the only musician in my family as far back as anyone knows was my great-grandfather on my mother's side was a klezmer violinist. In the last few years of his life, he actually taught students at Juilliard. So any musical inclination or ability, I feel like, must have been passed down from him.
Yeah, it's in the family.
Yeah.
Are there any other musicians in your family? Do you have any siblings?
My siblings, each of us definitely got the bug. My sister was a fantastic cellist, still plays, also a pianist. My brother, I sometimes say, is the best musician in the family. He plays oboe. Last year, in his senior year of high school, he's at Penn now. He won the concerto competition to play this oboe concerto in the side-by-side concert with the BSO, which was a big thing for him.
I guess.
And, yeah,
what is his name?
Leo.
And your sister?
Sister is Stephanie.
And your parents?
Older sister, younger brother.
Your parents, John is your father, the mm-hmm. congressman, and right. your mother is Dina.
That's right.
Are either of them musically inclined?
My dad, I think, played piano for maybe a couple of years when he was a kid, and my mom, by her account, played French horn for 3 months in high school. I think that was the extent of her musical experience.
Okay.
But the genes there somewhere.
So at 10, you took to the trumpet,
mm-hmm.
and who gave you lessons?
I think, well, I started out getting private lessons with my elementary school teacher, Alex Muller, out at Ridewood Elementary, and he was great. I actually working on my teaching certification, my degree right now, and I was able to go out and observe him, which was sort of funny to be observing him all these years later. And he's just a fantastic teacher, and I definitely credit him a lot with helping create that excitement for me when I first started. So he taught me, and then I went through, a few others. I feel bad now that I'm not recalling all the names.
Of teachers. That's okay.
But John Olin, who was one of my teachers at Towson High School later, I studied with him for a while.
So were you in the jazz band or marching band?
I was in the jazz band. I actually, I've been listening to jazz since I was a baby. I mean, the music that my parents were playing for me when I was a baby was Tony Bennett and Sinatra and Billie Holiday. I actually didn't start really focusing in on jazz trumpet until, well, I went to Dumbarton Middle School in the county, and they had a jazz band. So in like 7th or 8th grade, I started getting an idea of that. But I actually hadn't thought of pursuing it, honestly, beyond high school.
What did you like about jazz? Do you remember Because I can't imagine that every middle school kid takes to jazz. I mean, I love jazz. I love swing. I love big band. And I could see getting excited about that, but not every kid does, you know.
One of my trumpet teachers at university said the first music you hear, whatever it is, subconsciously that gets into your mind and that's going to stick with you, even if it's something eclectic that you wouldn't have chosen later on in life.
So you're blaming your parents?
I'm not blaming them. I'm thanking them.
I'm kidding. Well, they didn't play Mozart, which is what the rule was when my kids were little, was, you know, play Mozart for them.
Right. No, for us, it was jazz, musical theater, opera. I mean, yeah, our favorite CDs in the car when we were kids were like the soundtracks to My Fair Lady. Actually, which one of the tunes on the CD is from. My Fair Lady, West Side Story, Fiddler on the Roof. That's what we listened to. We had a Sinatra CD, Billie Holiday CD. My mom is obsessed with Tony Bennett, so he was always on.
He's a cool guy. He's like the world-class cool guy, isn't he?
Yeah.
So the jazz band at Dumbarton, do you have any memory of kind of pieces they played? Are any of those pieces still around that you play as an adult?
Oh, sure. I mean, I'm sure we played...
A jazz standard of some kind?
Yeah, I'm sure we played reductions of, like, classic big band scores, like In the Mood and things like that. I can't remember all the exact titles for you. But, yeah, we definitely played some standard, popular standards, A-Train, stuff like that.
By the time you were in high school, what were you doing with the horn?
I wasn't really thinking of pursuing music past high school, and actually my parents bring this up whenever I try to indicate that I'm absolutely 100% sure of something. They bring up that in my freshman year of high school, when they were sort of asking me as a preliminary question, where do you think you might want to go to college, and I had two things to say. I said, I don't want to go anywhere that's cold, and I don't want to play trumpet in college.
So you ended up at
in Montreal.
McGill at in Montreal, Canada.
So, as I said, they bring that up pretty regularly. Anytime I think I'm positive.
So how'd you end up at McGill?
Well, so the thing is, in about 11th grade, or 10th grade, I would say, there were some guys in the jazz band at Towson High School, and they sort of got me hip to Bird, Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Miles, all the people that you need to be listening to. Because up to that point, even though I liked jazz, my only real exposure to it was in a big band format or like accompanying a vocalist. So I hadn't been as familiar with the idea of small group jazz that really places the focus on the soloist. And I have to give a shout out to Charlie Sigler, who was in that band. He was in the band at Dumbarton and then at Towson also, and he gave me a lot of my first listening material. So that helped further my interest. And then Charlie went off to school to study jazz in college, and that was really the first time I'd understood that you could go to school for jazz. Before, I'd always assumed that if I was going to play trumpet in college, I would have to be in an orchestra. And I'm not knocking that style at all. I mean, I love listening to that kind of music, but there's some trumpet parts in classical music pieces where you play five measures and then you're resting for 95.
Right.
And then I wasn't going to be able to succeed really in that.
So how did that work out at McGill? What did you end up doing there during those 4 years?
I had a great time. In my time up there, I was lucky enough to get a pretty good following and pretty good name recognition. And actually, in my last year there, my group opened for Diane Reeves at the Théâtre Maisonneuve on the Place des Arts. And so that was the biggest performance we'd done to that point. And that was as a part of the jazz festival.
What was your group like?
It was quintet. That's normally the format that I perform in. It was trumpet and vocals, myself on trumpet and vocals. We had a guitarist, drummer, bassist, and pianist. Same as I do now. A combination of original compositions of mine and standards, mostly vocal standards out of Great American Songbook.
And when did the singing develop?
As I said, Tony Bennett was our lullaby, like when we were babies. So I've been singing these standards probably since I knew how to sing. I mean, the first things I was singing was probably these songs. And actually, we have home videos somewhere of my performance in, I think it was the first grade talent show, was of the Sadder But Wiser Girl from The Music Man. So that was my first grade talent show performance. Later on, there was one I did, The Tender Trap, a great Sinatra standard. So I've been singing for longer than I've been playing trumpet, actually.
So you know a lot of those tunes.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know the Bunny Berrigan tune, Can't Get Started With You?
Oh, yeah.
I've flown around the world in a plane.
I've flown around the world in a plane.
I settled revolutions in Spain.
I've settled revolutions in Spain.
The North Pole I've charted.
Ooh. The whole North Pole I've charted,
but I can't get started with you. Very good. Yeah, very good.
I haven't sung that one in
a
while.
Some great lyrics.
There's a great...
It's Vernon Duke, isn't it? Vernon
Duke. And there's a great Clifford Brown recording of that ballad. And Clifford Brown is probably, of all the jazz musicians that existed in the world, he's hands down my favorite. And just as a person and a musician, he sort of brought this virtuosic approach to trumpet, that jazz trumpet, that hadn't really been seen before, and he broke the mold, sort of. But also as a person, he was the first jazz musician to sort of show, Sonny Rollins actually said this, because Sonny Rollins played with him in 55 and 56. He said that Clifford was the first jazz musician to show you can be a successful, consummate musician and not be on drugs. Because up to that point, everyone thought, because Bird did what he did, that's what he had to do. Yeah. And Clifford was completely clean. Yeah, his example, it's funny, I've talked about him before, and I think because of not just who he was as a musician, because he does have a very warm sound that draws you in, but even beyond that, because of who he was as a person, it's funny how when you talk to jazz musicians now, they will speak about Clifford often in a very affectionate way, almost as like a family member. More so, like when you hear them talk about Bird or Coltrane, it's more a sort of reverent, you know, this is a jazz god, and, you know.
Right.
But it's not so much a family connection, whereas when people talk about Clifford, it's like it's a family member.
There is some tradition of band leaders singing, playing the horn and singing.
Mm-hmm.
When did you first do that, though? You know, actually getting to the microphone, the trumpet at your side.
Right.
And then singing into a mic to a room full of people. What the first time you actually did that?
That would be, I think that was the fifth grade talent show at Ride. It was the Tender Trap, and I would sing a verse, and then I would. There was no backing track or anything, so I was sort of on my own. But I would, I would sing a verse, and I would play a little.
That's pretty daring for fifth grade.
Yeah.
What about in college? When you had your group in college?
Oh yeah, yeah.
So you would sing as well as play.
Mm-hmm. And. Obviously, working on the trumpet is going to be a lifelong thing, but it has only been in recent years that I really started pursuing, really only last year, getting better technique on the vocals. Because up to that point, you know, I had just been singing in the way that I'd always sung. And yeah, a couple of years ago, I started really investing in trying to sing correctly, while also trying not to lose the organic sort of quality of it.
She whistles night and noon. Her smiles, her frowns, her ups, her downs are second nature to me now. Like breathing out and breathing in.
So what's your ambition? You want to be a school teacher, so you get a day job, but
right.
you're pretty serious about pursuing this. Who knows where it'll lead?
I'm going to be making a big decision in the coming months about whether to go straight into the workforce as a teacher, which I love. I love teaching kids. Whether to do that or to make the move to New York and try to pursue performance further. If it were up to me, and I tell people this all the time, I would love to just be in Baltimore the rest of my life. Baltimore is definitely a part of me. So if it were up to me, I'd be able to just be here forever and not have to go somewhere else to make it happen. But that's how the business is. So we'll see.
But do you think about a career as a musician? You still think about it? You're still...
Oh, yeah.
How old are you?
I am 23.
Yeah. So you could still think about that, right?
Right. In an ideal world, I try not to talk about pipe dreams or other things like that. But... In an ideal world, I mean, I would love to be able to do, well, really what the other artists on this album have done, which is grew up in Baltimore and then are now touring musicians who tour globally.
Who's on these recordings with you?
So we've got Antonio Hart, who is a fantastic, fantastic alto saxophonist, who I've been listening to, again, when I first started listening to small group jazz in the middle of high school, I wanted to find as many Baltimore artists as I could to understand not just the history, but also an idea of what the Baltimore sound is like. Because I do think there is a distinct Baltimore sound to the scene here that is very just infused with blues. So Antonio's on here. We've got Warren Wolf, who I don't think you'd find much argument anywhere if you said he's probably the best jazz vibraphonist in the world right now. I mean, he's unbelievable. And another thing that I admire so much about Warren is that he is still in Baltimore. He's doing everything he's doing. He's touring all around the world, playing with the who's who in this music, and he's still centered. He hasn't forgotten his hometown. So he's on here playing Isfahan. We've got Leonard Harper, fantastic drummer, who I met at a camp in Connecticut one summer in high school, and we found out that we were both from Baltimore. I knew that at some point down the line, I wanted to put something together with him. And then finally, we had Tim Green, another amazing alto saxophonist, again, coming out of that just Baltimore sound, that gritty, bluesy tinges of gospel. And these are guys who are playing all over the place, and for them to agree to do the shows with me, because again, I mean, I was in 2015 a 22-year-old kid who, you know, didn't think that most of these people would say yes, but in keeping with the Baltimore spirit that I've noticed in everyone in the scene here, everyone's just very open and encouraging and genuine, and there's very little pretension here.
What would you say about jazz as in 2017 as an interest for people in the music world? There's so much competition for our ears.
Right. Well, there's been, in the last couple of years, some pretty bleak assessments of jazz's place in the musical landscape. And I think part of that, jazz is actually, a lot of stuff could qualify as jazz, but might, for the purposes of those surveys or those studies, choose a different label. But I think another big part of it is that since the last sort of evolution of the genre has been very much towards a freestyle of jazz, and this very sort of visceral, you know, spontaneous kind of thing, not so much the traditional harmony, I think that there's a lot of people who, if that's been their only exposure to jazz, because it's been the most recent iteration of it, if that's not something that they're down with, they're not gonna take it upon themselves to do research and find out if there's other jazz that they might like.
Mm-hmm.
And I think another thing, and I'm not in any way meaning to offer any indictments of my peers, because I mean, I appreciate all styles of the music, but I do think that there's a lot of jazz musicians in this contemporary scene. They're music making is meant more for themselves than for the audience. It's sort of an attitude of, and I've seen this a lot of places, and these are fantastic musicians, but there's a mentality of, well, we're going to play what we want to play, and if it's too complex for you, that's your problem.
It's called self-indulgent.
Right. And so for me, there's, I think that you have to show a respect for your audience and your audience's tastes by at least, you know, giving them something. My favorite quote of any jazz musician was Cannonball Adderley, who was, I mean, outside of Clifford Brown, in terms of someone whose sound I've tried to emulate, Cannonball's the guy. And he said that I play 50% of what people want to hear and 50% of what they need to hear. And for me, that sums it up perfectly.
It's like a perfect place to be, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. If you listen to Cannonball's recordings, I mean, he was an absolutely just virtuosic musician, but every single thing he played just grooved like hell. Like, people could dance to it, people could get up and clap their hands to it, and he really, I think, is the epitome of striking that balance perfectly, and I think that's an example. His is an example that I think a lot of young jazz musicians could learn from.
We also had moments when someone becomes really popular. A performer becomes like the Marsalis Revolution, you could almost call it, right? Harry Connick Jr., just to name a couple there. So that helps it along, too. So today, when you go to an audience, though, you know people want to be there, right? That's one thing you can say about jazz, right?
Hopefully.
Huh?
Hopefully. I think some people sometimes might go with a certain expectation of what it might be.
Yeah.
And then occasionally they're disappointed because they think it's going to be one thing. I mean, that's how it is with any kind of music, I guess.
Yeah.
But
if you go to the BSO for, you know, Beethoven, and they throw in a Schoenberg, mm-hmm, or an Alban Berg,
right,
wind chamber concerto that sounds like a 20-minute car wreck, you know, it can.
Right.
But don't worry, the Beethoven's coming. So anyway, so why don't you just talk about something for Smitty?
Okay, sure.
So this is yours. I mean, do you write it down? Did you improv?
The compositions, I mean, a lot of times my tunes will come out of improvisations. Like, I'll just be practicing and working on some improv stuff, and if I hear an idea in my improv that I think can be turned into a tune, then I'll write it down. Other times it'll come from working at the piano explicitly with the idea of creating a composition. This one, I think, came out of soloing in the practice room. Well, the story starts at this barbershop that is sort of a Baltimore staple, Avara's.
Avara's Academy of Hairstyle.
Right, exactly.
Right.
And my grandfather has gone there for, I don't know, maybe close to 40 years. My father's gone there for maybe 30, 35, and in keeping with the family tradition, I started going there in high school. And
which one? The old place on Pratt Street or down in Dundalk?
First, we went to the one at Pratt Street, and then that one, I think, closed
right?
A couple of years ago.
Yeah.
So we followed our barbers to the one in Dundalk.
In Dundalk. And Sayavara, who founded the place, died,
mm-hmm,
a couple years ago. But anyway.
But his son still works there, and mm-hmm, Larry. And Lee is the guy who does our hair. I don't know if we'll hear this. Probably not. But there's a shout-out to Lee. And but there's another guy who works there named Smitty, who we would see every time we went in, and we would talk about the Ravens and the Orioles and just sort of shoot the breeze. And, you know, he always sort of stuck out to me as, you know, a great barbershop sort of character in there. So, yeah, when I was thinking of what to call this tune, you know, one of the first things you do when you write music is think of, you know, either experiences that it conjures up for you or people it conjures up. And I like to try to connect them to Baltimore experiences and Baltimore people, so I thought that would be a fun connection. It's taken a little bit longer than anticipated, but I am happy to say that the CDs will arrive on my doorstep on Friday, and so they will be available for purchase, and we're going to put it online on Amazon and iTunes and everything.
What do you call it?
It's just Nico Sarbanes Live in Baltimore. I didn't want to mess with it too much.
Well, Nico Sarbanes, thanks for being almost live on our podcast.
Sure. I appreciate the opportunity.
Good luck to you.
All right, thank you.
Nico Sarbanes performs this weekend at the Mid-Atlantic Jazz Festival in Rockville, Maryland. Information about his debut album with Warren Wolf, Tim Green, Winard Harper, and Antonio Hart is available in the notes with this podcast. That's our show. Hope you enjoyed it. Please review Roughly Speaking on iTunes if you get a minute. For producer Steve Early in the Baltimore Sun Newsroom, this is Dan Rodericks. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent, locally owned bookseller. The shop offers the best in literature, current affairs, history, poetry, and, of course, books about Baltimore. The Ivy is located at Falls Road at Lake Avenue in Mount Washington. Check us out at theivybookshop.com. The right book is waiting.